There we go.
Would you like
Thank
to
you.
Start? Should I start off?
Thank you, Representative Yi Wah-Kim, to explain House File 1121.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing House File 1121 today. I know you have a packed agenda, so I'm going to be brief. The idea for this bill was brought before me by my neighbor that's here today, Catherine Newcomb. Her husband, Charlie, was in a bad accident in 2015, and it has taken me that long to get a hearing on this bill, so I really do appreciate it. You will hear Ms. Newcomb's testimony and request next, but I wanted to give you a little background. In current Minnesota law, motorcyclists are only required to carry or provide security payment for tort liability arising out of maintenance or use of the motorcycle in the state, but the security, of course, may be provided by a contract of liability insurance. So you see this on lines 1.8 and through 1.10 in the bill before you. Motorcyclists are not required to carry personal injury protection or uninsured, underinsured coverage, and your automobile insurance policy does not extend to you in the event of a motorcycle accident. This bill merely requires a motorcyclist to carry uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage. The coverage is available, and some folks do carry it. Those that do are protected when hit by another uninsured or underinsured motorist. Just a quick fact. Nationwide, about 14% of the folks on our roadways are not carrying insurance. Why do I think it's important to carry this coverage? Well, number one, it is to protect the folks riding their bikes, motorcycles. Number two is also to protect others. We require this insurance in our automobile policies. Why? Because we know the cost to the rest of us when motors are injured and not fully covered. I'm new to delving into this policy area, and I know that there's those on this committee that know way more than I do about insurance. But I do understand the balance our system has tried to strike in requiring folks to purchase a variety of insurance. If it becomes too expensive, folks may go uninsured. So that really always, I understand that push and pull, and I get that. That's why I'm trying to strike a balance in this bill by only requiring underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage instead of personal injury protection as well. I've consulted with Mr. Bob Johnson to find out what this would actually cost the average rider. And as in all cases, it depends on the age of the rider and the type of the motorcycle. This could increase a rider's insurance anywhere from 25% to 60%. For example, a 45-year-old motorcycle owner at a lower liability limits would go from $100 to $160 to add uninsured motorist and underinsured motorist coverage. A 50-year-old rider would go from maybe $125 to $180. But then if you had an 18 to 25-year-old riding a racing bike, you could see an increase from $1,000 to $1,700 because, yeah, they're a riskier bet. You should know that today many motorcycle owners already put this valuable coverage on their bikes. Agents surveyed have said they sell this coverage today with the majority of their customers around 70 to 80% buying it. So is this a solution in search of a problem? I would say it's actually catching our statutes up to where the market's already going. But I would like you to first hear from Mrs. Newcomb and hear her personal story.
Thank you, Representative Joaquim. Welcome to the committee, Representative Newcomb, and if you can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Kathy Newcomb. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Commerce Committee. On June 5, 2015, my husband Charlie was injured in a motorcycle accident. Charlie sustained multiple injuries, including fractures to his left wrist and both hands, as well as a dislocation to his left leg, which resulted in a total left hip replacement. We are fortunate La Crosse Blue Shield of Minnesota paid Charlie's medical bills for the week in the hospital, 3 weeks in transitional care, and follow-up medical care. The driver of the other vehicle was uninjured and immediately admitted fault for the accident. After investigation, the insurance company for the other vehicle accepted 100% liability. However, the bodily injury limits under their policy were the minimum requirement under Minnesota no fault of $30,000. Charlie had bodily injury limits of $100,000 to $300,000, property damage of $50,000, and comprehensive coverage on his bike. Unfortunately, he did not have uninsured or underinsured protection on the bike. His medical expenses alone far exceeded the available liability coverage. Therefore, he was uncompensated for his pain and suffering, permanent injuries, loss of income, past and future, In addition to my loss of time from work and out-of-pocket expenses and traveling to attend to him during his stay in the hospital and transitional care, as well as follow-up doctor appointments. Prior to the accident, Charlie was always on the go. He enjoyed friends, sports, and having a good time. He was always up to a challenge. Charlie held a full-time job within a family business, demonstrating items, kitchen and yard tools, requiring travel 7 to 8 months out of the year. Since the accident, Charlie's travel is limited, approximately 1 month a year. This is due to the fact that he cannot stand for 10 to 12 hours demonstrating as he once could, and can no longer sit for long lengths of time driving to and from his working obligation. As a result, our son has taken over a large portion of my husband's family business obligations. Since the accident, it takes Charlie longer to get moving in the morning and sometimes throughout the day. Home projects, honey-do lists that Charlie tackled in the past on his own now take 2 to 3 times longer for him to complete, and often they require the assistance of my son or others. The additional metal in his wrists and hip as a result of the accident now make winters almost unbearable, as Charlie is constantly cold, even when he is wearing additional cold weather protective gear. Charlie no longer uses the portable house fishes he owns and dreams of skiing as he once did, but has not skied since the accident. Family vacations to warm spots used to include golfing and deep sea fishing excursions with friends, as well as walks on the beach. Unfortunately, the surgeries to the wrists now make golfing and deep sea fishing difficult or impossible, and evening walks in the sand are not as enjoyable after the left hip replacement, as walking on the uneven beach can be difficult and uncomfortable. Day-to-day tasks like buttoning a shirt or removing compression socks at the end of the day can be a frustrating burden and require assistance. Lists followed by gentle reminder calls and scavenger hunts for items misplaced are a common daily routine. As a result, my husband is not the carefree individual we knew prior to June 5th, 2015. He gets frustrated and angry with himself, and is not as happy as he was before. I've noticed "I'm sorry, Mom." Mom, being how Charlie refers to me, has become a common daily phrase I did not hear before the accident. I am here today to request that motorcycles be required to carry uninsured and underinsured coverage, the same provision as other vehicles, and I would hope that in the future, this committee would also consider raising the minimum limits on the Minnesota no-fault provisions from $30,000 to $100,000. When the Minnesota no-fault law was originally enacted, the cost for medical care and living expenses were far less than they are today. Charlie will never be the same individual he was prior to the accident, or able to accomplish some of the same day-to-day items he could before. We realize this change in law will not help us, but it will protect others from being in our situation. By sharing Charlie's story, I hope to persuade a change in the Minnesota no-fault law by improving the minimum coverage provisions on motorcycles by requiring that they carry uninsured and underinsured coverage, and in the future, increasing the minimum limits on all Minnesota no-fault policies. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Ms. Newcomb, and I'm very sorry about the accident that your husband suffered and the change to your lives that you guys are suffering. So give him my best, give him our best. There are a couple of folks who have signed up to testify to this bill. Rich Ruhinen, followed by Jeff Sieben. And while they're coming up, members, we do have our quorum, so we will start with a couple of pieces of business. First of all, I would wonder if I can get a motion to adopt the minutes from March 5th.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Dean moves the minutes of March 5th. Is there any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. I will now move in front of us officially House File 1121 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Joaquim, you can introduce your testifiers in the order that they would like to go. And just for the record, everybody, it is Ash Wednesday. We know we've been working lots of long hours. I do not intend to go over committee time today because I know that people have evening obligations on a holiday. And so we will be brief and as succinct as possible today.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I had just actually found out about people wanting to testify on Monday, so thank you for your patience. Awesome. I have, first I'll have Mr. Jeff Stephen from the Stephen Carey.
Mr. Stephen, welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Jeffrey Stephen, attorney representing Stephen Gosala, seated on my right. I was asked to testify regarding motorcycle underinsured and uninsured coverages. With Mr. Gosala as an example of people in our community who would be affected. And a year ago next week, Mr. Gosala was driving his motorcycle, injured when an at-fault motorist collided with him, gave him a severe brain injury, and also a severe brachial plexus injury. You can see evidenced with his arm sling still. So he's been unable to secure employment due to his injuries, and the at-fault driver had $100,000 in motorist insurance liability coverage that's been tendered to him. He did purchase insurance on his motorcycle prior to the collision, but was not sold underinsured or uninsured coverage as would be required by this bill. Situation that he was put in, it caused him to have medical bills that far exceed the coverage of $100,000 by the at-fault driver that was tendered to him. And it's been our experience, my experience personally representing folks, many just like Stephen, that this bill would affect and would help put lives back together just like Stephen Gosala. And he's with me today, but he was having a hard time remembering some simple thoughts to say, but if he has something.
Welcome to the committee. Can you introduce us by saying your name?
And yes, of course. My name is Stephen Gosala.
Thank you.
And
anything else you'd like to share?
You've got to help. You know, I want to do what I can for future riders.
Thank you for your coming to the committee today. Would you care to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members. My name is Rich Roon, and I am the president of the Minnesota Association for Justice and also a partner at TSR Injury Law. And I'll just make this quick because I know you're on a time crunch here. But I've represented hundreds of people just like we've seen and heard here today. And one of the problems with not having underinsured motorist coverage is the health insurers and the state of Minnesota often end up footing the bill for these negligent drivers because I had one client who had close to $1 million in medical bills, and they were all paid by the state of Minnesota, obviously at a discounted rate following this, but no underinsured motorist coverage on motorcycles, and we require it for automobiles. So why we don't require it for motorcycles is really doesn't make a lot of sense. But clearly, when there's negligent drivers involved, a lot of times a majority of drivers are driving with $100,000 or less. And when a person gets hurt on a motorcycle, often it's catastrophic. So I think this bill would go a long ways towards helping injured people and also making sure that the bill is not footed by the state of Minnesota or private health insurers. So thank you. That's all.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Oh, sorry. Please come forward.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Mark Kuhn. I'm president of the St. Croix Valley Riders. We're a motorcycle rights organization located in St. Paul Park, Minnesota.
You may proceed. Thank you.
The stance, I represent 1,500 motorcycles in the state of Minnesota, and our stance on this bill is we do not agree with it, even though it was a good idea. This coverage is available to anybody that rides a motorcycle. So our stance is it shouldn't be mandatory. We should all have proper coverage, and that should be up to the person riding.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else from the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, unless I'm corrected. we can proceed with member discussion and questions. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Joaquin. I don't disagree that this is needed, but I do agree that it should be, as it is now, a choice to do so. I went back and checked with my insurance agent, and I'm happy to say that I'm doing a good job, which is great. But when I look at the fact that my husband is looking at buying a newer motorcycle this summer, possibly something like a 2017 Indian, a Roadmaster, which can be quite expensive, we are looking at a significant difference. And I would rather see us go after or look at or do something with the folks who are uninsured. I don't think it's fair that we ask folks who are already buying insurance and doing the right thing to foot the bill for those that aren't. So it would be very, I would love it even more if we would have something that would somehow do something that would do a better job of capturing who those folks are and have them pay for what they aren't doing right, because a lot of our folks are doing things right. You talked about the street bikes, and for a 30-year-old who has a bike, and you can talk to Representative Heinzman because he drives one to work in the spring, you're looking at $250 extra. That's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. And if they're already insuring their bike and doing what they're supposed to, it just feels wrong to tax that kind of money on them just because somebody else isn't doing their part. So I guess I would just encourage you to probably, or maybe we can talk offline, about maybe some ways we can actually try and capture those folks that are not insuring themselves and not having to keep it a choice as it is right now. If you want to carry it, you can. And I just believe that's a better thing to do. So with that, just I'm glad you're bringing this issue forward. We have too many uninsured and underinsured, and we need to do a better job of making sure that happens. And I'm very welcome to talk to you, or I'm very excited to possibly talk to you and see if we can do something in that manner.
Representative Joaquin, would you like to respond or go to the next question?
Mr. Chair, I'm free to go to that next question.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Joaquin, I'm not really excited about requiring UI and UMI on motorcycles in the state of Minnesota, since that is available for separate purchase, just like we had learned earlier, excuse me, on a bill that was in front of this committee related to boat medical, that there was a policy that's already available in the industry. I guess I have a couple of quick questions for you. And number one, do you think that we could accomplish the same thing by advising people with a file review as the agent saying, you know what, if you have a motorcycle, here's some things to think about, without having to mandate coverage and then let the individuals make the choice on selecting that or not?
Representative Joaquin.
Madam Chair, I'm glad, Representative O'Driscoll, I'm glad you asked that question. That is what the underlying language already requires, but that's not always happening. And I don't know how often that's not happening. It's very hard to prove a negative. I did talk to my husband today because he does have a motorcycle. He, of course, has not been able to, he has chosen not to ride it for about the last 10 years, but he pulled up his history between him and his insurance agent about getting coverage back off and on. And granted, he did purchase his original motorcycle insurance, oh man, happy about 25 years ago, maybe before this law was requiring folks to notify it. But since he's repurchased policies and changed agents, no one's ever talked to him about underinsured or uninsured motorists or buying personal injury protection. despite the fact that they're supposed to state in at least 10-point bold type, if printed or in capital letters, on the application for motorcycle insurance. So I just don't know where that loophole is. I know that, as you know, just a quick brief survey that Mr. Bob Johnson did with some of the agents, 70% to 80% people are covering it, so you're right, people are taking some responsibility for themselves, but there's a big gap of folks that aren't, and those are the ones that are ending up costing us all a lot more in either health insurance or our own motorist coverage and just rates. And I understand there's a push and pull between, you know, asking people to purchase more insurance, $250 over the course of the year versus the kind of medical bills Mr. Newcomb suffered and Mr. Stephen Brossier suffered, I think is a good bet. That's why we have insurance. But maybe that's just a different philosophical discussion for a later date.
Representative O'Driscoll, follow-up.
Yes, and again, I was asking for a brief answer, but I got a comprehensive one from Representative Joaquin. Thank you. You know, if you do suspect that there are issues where that's not being done, And I do believe that most agents, if not the vast majority of agents in the state of Minnesota, do take their job seriously, representing the insurance company and advocating for suitability for their insurance, because no one wants to have to knock on the door of somebody who wasn't insured and have to present a check to them in the way of a death benefit from a life insurance policy. If you're doing your job, you're covering both areas for people. Representative Joaquin, you've chosen UI and UMI as the remedy for the situation you're talking about. Why didn't you choose personal injury protection? Because that's also available under law for motorcycles, but not mandated as well.
Representative Joaquin.
Madam Chair, I had to look back in my files and my notes because, like I said, I started this bill 3 years ago when I went up to House Counsel. If I heard from Ms. Newcomb, and back then and now, looking at the runs of PIP seemed to be a lot more expensive. I would have liked to include all of it. I would like to include coverage that like we have on our cars, but I also try to always, and I've always tried to do this, strike that balance and find something that would be sustainable so that you wouldn't be pushing people out of the market if you've been buying insurance too. So I'd be more than happy to add PIP in there. But I don't want to push this coverage so, you know, out of reach. Maybe the market will eventually change that. I don't see actuaries changing the risk tables anytime soon, but I just didn't want to put something that out there that was so expansive people couldn't afford it.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Just a final comment. Once again, during the testimony today, we had heard from one of Representative Joaquin's original testifiers that you know, that since Minnesota became a no-fault state, those limits haven't been increased over time. They have been modified, but they may not have been increased. And the challenge that we have as this legislature and others in the industry debate these things, the higher premiums go, the higher the uninsured rate goes as well because of the financial obligations and costs associated with that. I would fully and wholly agree with the testifier's comment that costs for medical, costs for vehicles, costs for replacement have gone up. But once again, when we're looking at, you know, the numbers vary anywhere from 3 to 5 to 6%, depending upon who you talk to, of the vehicles that are on the road that are uninsured. And again, I can tell you from my time on the road, going back and forth from my district, I see a lot of vehicles that have expired tabs as well. So it's telling me that there's good evidence that people are having difficulty being able to afford tabs. Perhaps they're also having difficulty affording the insurance on those vehicles as well. And I would caution the legislature to stand clear of doing things that would intentionally raise the cost of insurance that might have unintended consequences. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Dean. And members, I would like to vote on this bill in under 5 minutes so that we can hear the rest of our agenda.
So just briefly, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Joaquin. I purchase my motorcycle insurance and my car insurance online, and I've never had an agent ask me or inform me about other types of coverage. So I think as we also need to recognize that the insurance industry is changing, how people purchase insurance. So if we put, you know, requirements for agents to raise this to individuals, that's not just people. And I don't know if you all spend all the time reading every little clause and every little thing online when you purchase something, especially insurance. That I think we need to be cautious when we put in place mandatory requirements of disclosure by agents and things like that, because our world is changing and things aren't quite the same when agents like, you know, Chair Davids would have asked us specifically about, you know, do you know about this, do you know about that, do you know, he goes down his list. That doesn't quite happen the same way when you purchase insurance online.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, you know, the American Bikers for Awareness, Training, and Education are kind of like one of the most respected groups here at the Capitol in terms of their longstanding advocacy for motorcycle riders. How involved were they in the crafting of this legislation?
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I introduced this bill 3 years ago and did not hear from them at all. So, and I didn't know, I have not heard of them. I didn't know to reach out. I know about a bait, but that's about it.
Representative
Same thing, Garofalo. Just
different. Yeah, Madam Chair. We did talk, yes, yeah. Then, if it's the same organization. Thank you. I didn't know the acronym.
Sorry. If you could, same question, replace what I said with a bait.
Representative Joaquin.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Garofalo. I am sure you could probably guess how that conversation went, and there wasn't a lot of room for compromise.
Okay. So, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
So, this is something that you've chosen to advance despite their opposition to this?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Joaquin.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I don't think I'm breaking any news or telling you anything you don't know already, but the likelihood that this is going to make it through the full legislative process and be signed by the governor is slim to none, and Slim just left the building. So I would say that I think it's a good idea. Abate is a very well-respected organization. I think a lot of times we share the same common goals. I know they do. I was listening remotely to what the I was listening to the audio up in my office, and I heard the stated goals for this legislation, and I think those are goals that they share with you. I think there's other ways to do it other than this legislation, and my advice just would be for members of the committee and you as well is to sit down with them. They're reasonable folks. I know that when they wear those leather jackets, it can be a little intimidating. I understand that, but they're like the nicest people you could ever meet here at the Capitol. They really are. And they're not highly paid lobbyists. Their motives are pure. They share the same goals as us. And when they oppose legislation in their arenas, they have like a 100% track record of blocking things. Likewise, they have a record of being results oriented. So I would urge members of the committee to oppose this legislation. I would urge the author to continue to work out with them. It's not always easy, but I would ask you to please continue working and trying to find compromise around those shared goals. But today, I think we should vote against this bill.
Representative Joaquin.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, thank you. And no, I'm not afraid of leather jackets. I missed it. My husband owns a bike, and I have a leather jacket, so we're just fine. More than happy to have that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Joaquin. Any further discussion from the members of the committee? Seeing none, last word, Representative Joaquin.
So, folks, I want to just say thank you. I know toward the end of deadlines, there's a lot of tight spaces on the agendas. I'm having that happen myself in my own committee and a lot of late hours, so I really do appreciate you hearing this bill. You've heard testimony from folks that have had personal experience with horrible situation. This bill obviously doesn't go backwards to help those folks, but it can help people into the future. I am trying to strike a balance to make sure our roads are safe and people are protected. I believe adding a requirement for motorists to carry uninsured and underinsured coverage just strikes that balance. So thank you for the conversation, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Joaquin. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1121 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails, and your bill is on your way to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Next on the agenda, I'd like to invite Representatives Liebling and Cantrell to come forward. Representative Cantrell, you, we're going to have to get this on my table. Or is Representative Schultz here? Or are we going to just recess?
So I believe they're presenting a bill on HHS policy.
That's no excuse.
So,
Representative Cantrell, have a seat.
Well, it's my pleasure, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank
you. For the members, information, two very similar bills were introduced. The intention is for the committee to take action on House File 1378, but Representatives Liebling and Cantrell were going to co-present the bills. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Cantrell, as we wait for Representative Liebling to arrive, are you willing to take up the presentation of the bill?
Madam Chair, I am. Okay. However, I am not a co-author on Representative Liebling's bill, so I don't know how that meshes with the quorum.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, just procedurally, are we going to move the Cantrell 1576 and then lay it over and advance the Liebling bill because they're similar? Or when you said we're bringing both those, just procedures, we have to have one at a time in front of us. Just want to know which one and how we're going to, from a...
Representative O'Driscoll, the intention is to bring forward in front of the committee House File 1378 and take action on that bill. We won't take action or bring up the Cantrell bill. Does that clarify?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So, Representative Cantrell, I call this stunt presenting. I've done it for other committees, but since you and Representative Liebling have worked together on your bills, I will move House File 1378 in front of the committee, and I'm going to look to see if there is an author's amendment.
You can make any one of them.
No, thank you. There is not an author's amendment, so Representative Cantrell, would you like to describe the bills that you and Representative Liebling are bringing forward, and we're going to act on the Liebling bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, and thank you, Madam Chair, for your flexibility here. House File 1378 is a bill that requires health maintenance organizations, or HMOs, to be nonprofit corporations in the state of Minnesota. So I have prepared a little bit of a presentation. Health management organizations have existed in the United States since 1973, and it has been since that time that they've been authorized to operate in Minnesota, that they've been required to operate as nonprofit corporations in our state. In terms of the comparison between the quality of health outcomes and the quality of care coverage, between for-profit and nonprofit HMOs, I did a little bit of a deep dive into the literature that's available to us, and I would like to share some of my findings with members of the committee. So there was a 1999 study published in the Journal of American Medicine that analyzed health plan employer data, or the health plan employer data and information set, composed of data from 248 investor-owned and 81 not-for-profit HMOs. The study found that investor-owned plans consistently scored lower than non-profit HMO plans in all 14 health plan employer data and information set quality of care measurements, which include the amount of folks who receive beta blockers after a heart attack. The contrast in that is for folks who had health care coverage through a nonprofit HMO, they were about 70.6% of them received beta blockers, and for folks enrolled in for-profit HMO plans, only about 59.2% of them received the same medication there as treatment for their heart attack. The study concluded that investor-owned health management organizations deliver lower quality of care than not-for-profit plans, and that's a quote from the study. The authors of the study further outline a key difference in the focus of for-profit health management organizations as compared to non-profit health management organizations, and again, verbatim. In investor-owned plans, executives' primary fiduciary responsibility and duty is to shareholders, who are vitally concerned with profits but unlikely to receive their medical care through the plan. However, a major concern is whether the quest for profit compromises the quality of care, and that is a study authored by Dr. Himmelstein in 1999 in the Journal of American Medicine. There was an excellent anthology study that was published in 2013 that really compiled a vast amount of the data available pertaining to kind of an analysis and the quality of coverage between plans offered through for-profit health management organizations and nonprofit health management organizations. And that study was published by Dr. Limor Daphne and Dr. Bear with me, Subramanyam Raman Arayanadyan of UCLA. And this paper was titled, "Does it matter if your health insurer is for-profit? Effects of ownership on premiums, insurance coverage, and medical spending." As I said, this was a thorough analysis of several studies, including a few that I'll go on to mention in my presentation, regarding comparisons in the quality of care offered by not-for-profit and for-profit health management organizations, as well as the impact of not-for-profit or for-profit HMO conversions on premiums, coverage, and medical loss ratios, which is the percent of consumer money spent on or spent by HMOs on patient care claims and improving quality of care, rather than on administrative overhead and executive pay. So a couple of the studies referenced kind of outlined some, I think, worrying trends. If we're looking at the long haul of allowing for-profit HMOs to do business in Minnesota and the perspective of currently not-for-profit HMOs being allowed to convert to for-profit entities. So Schneider et al. In 2003 analyzed data of Medicare plans offered through HMOs and found that for-profit health management organizations scored lower on four of the health plan. Let's see, what was that again? On the health plan employer data and information set, quality of care management or quality of care measurements. Those measurements were breast cancer screening, diabetic eye examinations, administering beta blockers after a heart attack, which I already mentioned, and follow-up after mental illness hospitalization. Gillies and others in 2006 and Tu and Rochowski in 2002 found that not only was consumer satisfaction higher for patients who enrolled in plans offered through nonprofit health management organizations, but in particular, Tu and Rochowski found that that this is true in regards to patients who are generally in poorer health. And then finally, Long in 2008 found that not-for-profit health plans do a better job providing sufficient health care coverage for Medicaid and for Medicaid recipients in less affluent communities. And I promise that I'm almost done. So a couple of the majors takeaway from this paper overall, and I'm quoting the paper. Considered as a whole, the results suggest that sizable conversions, and this paper focused primarily on sizable conversions pertaining to Blue Cross Blue Shield in various states. So the results suggest that sizable Blue Cross Blue Shield conversions resulted in higher prices, crowd into Medicaid programs, and no net change in medical spending per premium dollar. And as an aside, this is particularly pertinent to Minnesota, as about 2.9 million Minnesotans receive health care via Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota, and that's just over 50% of the market share. There is about 5.7 million Minnesotans living in our state as of 2017. Let's see here. I would also like to add that while in states that were analyzed for this conversion data for Blue Cross Blue Shield, in instances in which Blue Cross Blue Shield on average had a market share of around 20%, the changes in premiums, the changes in that medical loss ratio were fairly negligible. The projected statistical models in this paper project that by one standard deviation, which in this case was an increase of 27%, so if we're talking about Blue Cross Blue Shield having a 47% market share, these models project that insurance premiums in the event that Blue Cross Blue Shield converts from for-profit in this market, or excuse me, not-for-profit to for-profit in this market, these models project that that there could be an anticipated 7% premium increase. Let's see. Anyway, in kind of sum of my presentation leading up to the presentation of this bill, I have grave concerns that in the event that a for-profit HMO is I think UnitedHealth has already kind of indicated some interest in, were to bid and receive a contract from the state to administer Minnesota or medical assistance and Minnesota Care Health plans, the cost for those the often underserved Minnesotans could increase in a way that would be unpredictable, and the quality of their health care could diminish. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn the presentation over to Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Representative Liebling and Representative Cantrell. We have moved House File 1378 in front of us. I understand you were presenting in another committee. Happy deadline week, everyone. And so Representative Cantrell gave us a thorough introduction, and if you would like to highlight anything or walk us through any particular details of your bill, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the indulgence. I appreciate you hearing the bill and letting us have this flexibility. And thank you to Representative Cantrell. I'm not going to repeat what he said. His bill is pretty similar to mine. The only part that I would really like to highlight for the committee is the language around net earnings. And I know there are other bills about this, too, and I don't want to waste the committee's time if you've already had a discussion of this. You have not. Okay. Well, members, one of the things that happened in the last couple of years was that there was some language that was deleted from statute, repealed. And this is the language in Section 5 of my bill. And what was really kind of stunning about this is that there was essentially, and if someone can tell me when this was discussed, I'll stand corrected, but there really was no discussion, certainly on the floor. There was no discussion that this was happening. And you know, perhaps I should blame myself, but I did not realize at the time even that this language was being deleted. But essentially, this is language that's been in statute in Minnesota law for a very long time until it was deleted in the last session. And this is this language around all net earnings of the health maintenance organization shall be devoted to the nonprofit purposes of the health maintenance organization in providing comprehensive health care. So, and then it goes on to flesh that out a little bit. But that is basically it, that we have required nonprofit health plans, health maintenance organizations in this state to use their funds for the nonprofit purposes of the health maintenance organization. It's really hard to understand why anyone would object to that when it had been in statute for so many years and had guided our nonprofit HMOs in this state. And so with the repeal of that language, what we've seen now is we've seen that Medica has now transferred $175 million to other entities associated with Medica. Now, they've done this in different allocations. I think it was first $30 million and then at different times. And there have been different explanations about where the money was going. But the point is that we now no longer have any statutory leverage to say, hey, wait, wherever you're going to send it, whatever you're going to do with it, it better be for the nonprofit purpose of providing health care. Now, remember that because our HMOs have been nonprofits in this state, they have enjoyed a tremendous benefit that comes along with that status, which is that they don't pay taxes the way for-profit entities do. And so I think in a very real sense, especially because, well, it's hard to track, but there is some thought that a lot of the reserves that they have built up have also come from our public programs. So I think there's a very real sense in which Minnesotans feel that this is public funds and that we have an interest in this money. And we've always had this language and statute all these years that said that they had to use their net earnings. Remember, they're nonprofits. They don't have profit. They have net earnings. And those net earnings had to be used for the nonprofit purposes of the HMO in providing comprehensive care. So that's a really important part of this bill. And I know that some other bills are carrying this language as well. But thank you, Madam Chair, and that's all I really would like to say.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. There are a couple of amendments, and we do have one public testifier. Are either of these amendments yours, Representative Liebling? I guess there's three.
I don't know what you've got, Madam Chair. I had asked to have one, but I don't know if it actually got to you or not.
Okay.
No, okay. I don't believe it's in there.
Okay. With that, if committee members are amenable, we will take our public testimony and then deal with the amendments. Thank you. Jim Groats. And if you want to pull up an extra chair there, Representative Liebling, you're welcome to. Welcome to the committee. We are going to try to vote on this bill in the next 20 minutes, so I'm trying to make sure everybody keeps testimony brief. We will try to keep it to 3 minutes. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Groats, and I'm from Edina, Minnesota. And I'm here to speak to this bill. I find it interesting on the net profits that Representative Schultz's bill, which has not yet been heard, pretty much has the same language as is found in this bill on Subdivision 8A net earnings. One of the problems we have in this state as consumers is that this has been a game of easy money. And these nonprofits really have no oversight. This is something you must understand, and the for-profits really have limited oversight. The primary regulator in this state is the Department of Health. In 2011, I started going through their archives, and I was told by the registrar, we assume everyone is honest. And then over the years, I've come to realize when working with other individuals that are like-minded looking at this, that there's no one reading these insurance company financial statements. No one. So we found, for example, starting in 2011, Blue Cross Blue Shield transferred out $300 million as dividends from their Minnesota nonprofit, primarily earnings from Blue Plus. And fortunately, Representative Liebling highlighted this in an earlier committee meeting talking about Medica. And everyone who was listening was shocked. Why are we taking these earnings, pushing them out of all places to Wisconsin for a teeny tiny insurance subsidiary? It's very troublesome. What happened to the old-time concept where earnings were to be used the subsequent year and years to reduce premiums? It appears no one is watching. I do realize that more competition might be good for prices, but we have no assurance of that. And the key is there's nobody watching. The other problem we've had is there have been no audits. We have not audited our public health plan expenditures of over $5 billion per year. That's a lot of money. We're required under the Single Audit Act and the Single Audit Act amendments of 1996 to audit, to rigorously audit, and we have failed to do that. We're also required to audit under Minnesota statutes. My concern here is that...
And Mr. Groats, just so you know, you're at 3 minutes, so
okay.
If you want to speak to the bill and wrap up your
testimony. My concern is that because we haven't had audits, if the feds come in and do something, it might be better off just to keep things the way they are with nonprofit HMOs because there may be some clawbacks, and I do not want the taxpayers to be at risk of clawback here. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Come on down. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jay McLaren, and I'm the Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations at Medica. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this. And I know this is a topic that was the subject of a committee hearing in Representative Liebling's committee a number of weeks ago, and she referenced that. And I'm happy to come before this committee and give you all some background as to some of the background information that's been shared with you and give you a broader context exactly as to what the fund transfers have been at Medica and where they've gone and what purpose that they've gone for. So what's being handed out right now is a flow chart of our organizational structure. So I'll wait for that to get in front of all members so that we can have a conversation about that, because that gives you the context that's missing here from this conversation. Part of the background that I'd like to share with you all is that our organization started as an HMO in 1974, but that was the very first entity that opened under Medica, and it was under the name Physicians Health Plan, and that name's changed over the years. But what hasn't changed over the years is that we continue to be non-for-profit all the way from our holding company throughout our organization. So that entity back in 1974 started offering coverage to commercial members in Hennepin County, and then it went statewide and primarily served commercial members or employers for a number of years before in 1984 our employers started asking us if we can offer them out-of-network coverage, which our HMO under the laws in the 1980s could not offer. So what we did in the mid-1980s was create an insurance company to offer that benefit for those employers that wanted that out-of-network coverage, because that was the only option that was available. And at the time, there were two options when you created an insurance company. It was either to be a mutual company, which is owned by the members, and that doesn't fit with our business structure and model. And the second was to be a stock company. So that's what we created. So to give you a little bit of background on the chart here, what's happened over the last couple years, and as Representative Liebling said, the law was changed in 2017 to allow funds to be transferred outside, for us, is the entity to the left there, Medica Health Plans, to other parts of our organization. So the first transfer was from Medica Health Plans up to our holding company, and then down to that next entity to the right of it, Medica Health Plans of Wisconsin. That entity was opened, gosh, I think sometime in the 1980s in order to offer coverage in Wisconsin, because we could not get our HMO license in Wisconsin. You have to have an entity domiciled in Wisconsin there. And at the time that we transferred the $30 million to that entity, it primarily served our Minnesota individual market customers. And it was not as well reserved as it could have been at the time for the amount of risk that it was taking on. So that was the rationale and the reason for the $30 million transfer.
And Mr. McLaren, just so you know, we're trying to keep our public testimony to 3 minutes each, so if you can wrap up or speak to the bill, that would be really helpful, and because we have some more bills to hear. So.
Okay.
But this background is helpful, and our other testifier went over, so we'll give you a little latitude. But
okay, thank you. Madam Chair. The other couple things I wanted to let you know just very quickly is that there have been transfers to our insurance company, which is the green diamond in the middle and the bottom. The important piece of context I want everyone to understand is the only shareholder of that insurance company is our not-for-profit holding company at the top. There are no outside shareholders to that entity. So I think that's really important context for the committee to hear as they hear background information on this bill. I would also say, just in general, we have no position on the underlying bill. If the state chooses to go back to the way it was before 2017, we have no position on that. So thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. McLaren. And there are a couple of members who have questions. Are this for this testifier or
yes,
for others? Okay. Representative Spazinski.
My question was just in general, but if we can, if you have something specific for this testifier, why don't you go for that?
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, Representative Elkins, this was for this testifier.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I'd like to understand is we're moving money around these entities that are all within Medica, but why would we be shifting? What would be the justification for shifting monies, earnings from Minnesota to another state? Aren't we? It would appear that in the process we're somehow cross-subsidizing insureds in other states other than Minnesota.
Mr. McLaren.
Madam Chair and Representative Elkins. So the rationale is that we have been over time having fewer members in our HMO. So essentially what we are rebalancing the funds that are in our different entities in order to serve other entities that are taking on more membership. So a perfect example is Medica Health Plans of Wisconsin. It is just an entity that is domiciled in Wisconsin. In the spring of 2017, when we transferred $30 million into it, its primary market were people in the individual market in Minnesota. Those were most of the people that were covered under that entity. That's what we started offering individual coverage in Minnesota after 2014 in that entity. So saying that it's Medica Health Plans of Wisconsin just means that that's where that entity is domiciled.
Representative Elkins, follow-up.
Yeah, so the customers of that entity were actually Minnesotans?
Or Mr. McLaren?
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, yes.
Any follow-up, Representative Elkins? Or shall we come back? Okay, Representative Elkins.
So would the proposed legislation prevent a shift such as this?
Mr. McLaren.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, yes. And those are the rules that we operated underneath for our HMO for decades prior.
Representative Elkins.
I don't know. Like the author's reaction, I guess.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkin, for that great question, because nothing that Mr. McLaren said has explained why they need to be able to use their money for other than the nonprofit purposes of providing health care in order to do all these things, and why the removal of that language, which, as far as I've been able, nobody seems to want to claim credit for having deleted that language from our statutes. I don't know if Medica was instrumental in doing that, but certainly the change has resulted in their moving the money around. And if they're using it for the health care purposes of the nonprofit health care purposes of the organization, I don't see why this language would stop them.
Thank you.
Mr. McLaren, did you want to clarify if this was a language that Medica asked for?
Madam Chair, no, this is not language that we had requested at all.
Thank you. I just want to be sure that was on the record. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Liebling, I want to make sure you know more about this stuff than me. Okay, so I just, if I'm saying something wrong, just correct me. But I seem to remember back in first of all, let me start with, this was part of the premium subsidy bill in 2017, is that right? That the section you're mentioning?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, it was in one of the two bills, yes. I believe it was the premium subsidy. There were two bills that came kind of close, one after the other. One was the premium subsidy, one was the other was the reinsurance. I'm pretty sure this was buried in the premium subsidy bill.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, so I remember in 2018 very vividly that you gave a speech on this matter, and I remember it because I very rarely pay attention to healthcare debates on the floor. And you had made the case that, hey, folks, you got to watch this. We're getting our clocks cleaned here. And I'm summarizing your comments, but it's basically that Minnesota's public programs were going into these arenas, and then the money was being transferred out to other states to pay for other states' services. At that point, I leaned over to a colleague of mine, and I said, why is she saying that? And the colleague looked at me on this side of the aisle and said, because she's right. And I went, what? And he said that exactly what you were saying, that Minnesota's, we have these programs that are publicly, that we, public entities contract with these entities. They certainly are reimbursed for their costs, but they make a healthy amount of money, and then that money is being transferred out of the state to do lots of other things besides provide health care to Minnesotans. Have I accurately summarized what you said in 2018 and what you believe? If I'm mistaken, tell me what I'm wrong about.
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I don't think I could have gone quite that far because I didn't have actual knowledge, I don't think, that of what was being done with the money at that time. But certainly, I think by that point, I probably knew that this had been deleted from statute. So I can't confirm that, but could I hire you as my publicist?
No. No, I just...
Representative Garofalo.
I mentioned, and Representative, so you and I have both been here a long time, and there's areas where you have subject matter expertise that's better than mine, and vice versa. And I continue to be confused by this stuff. I do remember that, though, that when you said something that to me, it seemed very out of the ordinary, and people who I consider to be very knowledgeable on my side of the aisle validated that that is what is happening. So in terms of what it's being spent on, the important thing is that tax dollars, public programs, going to entities in Minnesota, there's a markup, or there's, I don't want to use the word profit, but that money that is intended for public programs in Minnesota is being transferred out of the state of Minnesota to do other things. Is that a fair thing?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Garofalo. You know, it's not well understood, at least by me, exactly which money goes. You know, these are companies that have more than one book of business, and so the reserves are not segmented. So we don't really know necessarily which money came from where. So it's, I think I wouldn't go as far as making that statement. But one thing is very clear. This language that required these companies to use their net earnings for these purposes was deleted. Now, why would anyone do that? And it happened, you know, in the proverbial dead of night without any discussion on the floor about why. No one has explained, not Mr. McLaren, not anybody has explained to me or to the other members who are concerned about this, why this was done. So I can, and I have had the Department of Health, which oversees them, say that the removal of this language has allowed these transfers to take place. Now, that is this, you know, if they're going to other nonprofits, then, you know, we didn't even need the for-profit change to allow that to happen. So that's not the issue. The issue is this language about how they use their money. And the reality is that, you know, they are earning this money under their nonprofit status, which I would argue is a gift that the Minnesota taxpayer gives to them because they have a mission, and we are, and, you know, when they're doing our public programs or any other thing they're doing it as a nonprofit, which means they are supposed to be mission-driven for the people of the state or for the stated mission of the organization. And that's where I have a problem, because why in the world are we removing right. that language that we've had and has worked well for us for so long, I think around 25 years.
Okay, so Madam Chair, and Representative Leaving, you're right, it's a tax preference, right, that they've basically earned it under a,
yep.
a less restricted set of rules. Okay, so now to the testifier from Medica, let's go to the money question here, right? I heard this before. I didn't believe it. People I trust on the I trust Representative Liebling, but people on my side of the aisle validated this was happening. That money, that you can actually follow the dollars that Minnesota taxpayers have funded into these programs, and those dollars have left the state of Minnesota. That's what colleagues I trust, people I respect, Representative Liebling says. Is that right? Is it wrong? And just please explain to the degree that you can.
Mr. McLaren.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, so that's one of the reasons why I talked about the history of our HMO and the different customers that we've served over time. So we started in the mid-1970s and offering coverage to commercial members, employers. That's the long we offered coverage to employers out of our HMO for a long period of time. So that's one line of business that our HMO has been in. Another is we offer individual coverage in North Dakota out of our HMO. That's another line of business that is out of Medica health plans on your chart. Another line of business that we've been involved in for a long time is Medicaid, and that is operated out of our HMO Medica health plans as well. So the way I would describe this, Representative Garofalo, is saying, number one, we serve the state as a vendor, much like many other vendors when it comes to public programs. And so we've executed on our contracts for those services with the state. And number two, I would liken the funds that we have in our HMO and many of our other lines of business as to a savings account of, you know, if I can use myself as an example, you know, how much of what's in my savings account is from the time that I worked at this employer versus that employer over time. You can't unparse it and untangle it over time, because once that's there, it goes to a bunch of several different purposes, meaning was money that we made one year through public programs in Minnesota lost in that entity to some other line of business that we're in. It's just you can't trace that back.
Representative Garofalo.
Representative Liebling, do you have any thoughts?
Representative Liebling.
I mean, I have some thoughts, but I'll let you go.
We have one more bill to do.
Well,
and we want to go to...
Madam Chair and Representative Gruffalo, I just would ask you to pass the bill. We have a lot more work to do on this topic, and I have to say that, you know this, we as legislators have sort of limited ability to delve into things. Yeah. We're covering a bunch of different topics. We're not subject matter experts. There is a lot more work to be done on this topic. This bill just really scratches the surface, but I would just ask members to support this. This is not going to be the final version of it by any means, but we're going to continue to work on this, and I will be interested in your input, as we move it along, and the input of any other members as well.
Madam Chair and
Representative Garoppolo,
I'm certainly interested in the Section 5 provision of your bill, if for no other reason than I just want to understand what is happening, and I guess I reject the notion that once we put money into a bucket, we can't track it. That is not something that I certainly understand. This is complicated, and I understand that healthcare is complicated, and you're transferring a lot of money back and forth. Money can be transferred and transferred back, but these are public dollars, and when they go to a nonprofit, in my eyes, they remain public dollars in the coffers of the nonprofit, and that's just concerning. I don't think we should be getting rid of the private sector competition. That's part of your bill, and I don't understand how that's integrated with this. I suspect I probably need a lot more committee hearings than just occasional hearings on commerce to understand this. But I do think, so just pivoting from that, I do think it is important that the for-profit operations that are allowed in Minnesota that really conformed us with the other 49 states in the country, I don't like anything where we're the only state doing something. And previous to 2017, we were the only state in the country, and correct me if I'm wrong, but before 2017, we were the only state in the country that was banning for-profit. I mean, United Health couldn't even offer health plans here. So that seems to me to be kind of not a good idea. But I am interested in hearing about this Section 5 issue. So are those issues severable, or is there an integration here that I don't understand?
Representative Garofalo, if you want to turn to the next item in your packet, bill, that language is actually in a separate bill as well. So, good question. Yes. Representative Lindley.
And I'm sure, Representative Garofalo, thank you. You know, part of the problem with the for-profit, non-profit thing is that there really wasn't enough consideration of what that was going to mean in the state and what kind of guardrails we need to build around that. And as I understand, the way this was done was just to take out the word nonprofit every place and think that took care of things, and it didn't. So I don't, I have to admit, I don't know enough about how that plays out, and I really appreciated Representative Cantrell doing some work on that. But, this is something we needed to move really carefully and thoughtfully on, because we are a state that has always had a nonprofit structure. And we have opened ourselves up to all kinds of concerns that we may not even know what they are. And that's why, but this is a stop along the way. We want to really consider this. And people who know a lot more than me are going to be weighing in to try to, figure out how we can best get our arms around this and make sure that our consumers in the state are best served. And that is, I think, the interest that we all share. We should all share. Some of us may care more about the market than others do, but ultimately, at the end of the day, we care about the consumer and people being able to get health care at a reasonable price when and where they need it.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Levin, thank you. And those opinions matter, but you're the decider now. You got all those finance accounts, and so that's what I care about is your thoughts on it. So I know you have more important things to do than educate me on this, but it's just and I don't know how serious you are about Section 1, but I think the for-profit stuff should stay. The Section 5 stuff, though, I'm going to need someone to explain to me why public funds should be leaving our state, because I don't get it. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. I've got two more member questions. We've got a few amendments, and I want to be sure we get to hear from the rest of the public. So, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just since I was on the list, just kind of talking a little bit, kind of moving towards that transfer idea. When you mentioned, the reason why money was transferred to Wisconsin is because they were serving Minnesota customers through that entity or whatever that was be. Do we have any instances where money has been transferred to Minnesota from other states?
Representative Liebling, Mr. McLaren.
Well, Madam Chair, and Representative Swedzinski, I don't know if we do, but I don't think that that would be really relevant to the bill. I mean, you know, if people want to send us money, I guess that's okay. But those other states would need to worry about where that money was coming from if it was their taxpayer money. I'm more worried about our taxpayers' money.
Madam Chair.
Mr. McLaren, I keep trying to get you elected. I'm sorry.
My dad was a state senator in Iowa. But that's
interesting.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Swedzinski, so again, to give the background on the funds that are being transferred, all of our entities report up to a nonprofit holding company based in Minnesota. The funds aren't going to different states. Our entities that we have serve primarily the Minnesota market, and those funds are there to serve our members there and in the other 8 states that we serve. There are no funds going to states.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you. And then just kind of one last comment. I'll just piggyback on Garofalo's, and I'll just be quiet for the rest of this particular bill. But, you know, I just think, you know, at the end of the day, the Department of Commerce, you know, we say the reason why we want to get rid of this for-profit portion is because it wasn't something that was thought through. Last time I checked, the Department of Commerce approves any plans that might be offered, and if it would be from a for-profit company, the Department of Commerce would probably still approve whatever would be potentially offered by that company. So I think to say that there aren't guardrails, we have a department dedicated to this, that would probably keep people from being hurt. And I, you know, as a rural member that doesn't have a lot of options when it comes to health care insurance, the last thing I want to do is slam the door on potential of what could be here. And as far as I'm understood, I don't think anyone, I mean, from a harm standpoint, I'm not sure has a for-profit harmed something. Is there plans out there that I don't know about? And there we go. I'll be quiet.
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to let you know that the Department of Health actually regulates HMOs. I mean, the things are really divided up, and we do it kind of based on the way things used to be, is how we have sort of the division of labor in terms of regulation, and that's part of the problem, is that we just weren't ready for this, and we didn't think it through properly and prepare for it. So that's part of it here, and the fact that, you know, most of us wouldn't even realize that was the case is sort of demonstrates that there are a lot of unknowns here.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, like Representative Garofalo, I get the idea that once you pour water into a bucket, you can't unpour it back into the original containers. What I don't understand is why there aren't separate buckets for the profit and the nonprofit.
Anybody wish to respond to that, Mr. McLaren?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, so in for-profit and non-profit, yeah, they are divided out in our org chart,
yep,
right, by the different entities that we have and the different lines of business that they offer in different portions. So there is a division between the non-profit entities that we have inside our structure, mm-hmm, and the for-profit entities that we have inside our structure.
Representative Elkins,
yes,
follow-up.
The water is cascading down from the non-profits to the profits. Mm-hmm.
Mr. McLaren.
The nonprofits are all at the top of the chart. The for-profits are down at the bottom. So the water is cascading down from the nonprofits to the profits.
Mr. McLaren.
Yeah, so Madam Chair and Representative Elkins, so yeah, there's some examples of some funds going from our HMO up to our holding company to an HMO in Wisconsin. And there are also instances of it going to the for-profit company on the bottom of the page. The only reason it's further down on the page is that we have this Medicaid-affiliated services, this blue circle there. The purpose for that entity, and again, a lot of this gets very complicated, but is to offer us one entity that reports on behalf of all of these taxable entities underneath it. It's basically for administrative ease in reporting what happens with all those other organizations underneath it. So I hope that gives a little bit of explanation as to why we're structured that way and why those for-profit entities are along the bottom of the page.
So just to meet
Representative Elkins.
So in other words, the Medica-affiliated services is a separate bucket?
Mr. McLaren.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, yes.
And no nonprofit money flows into that bucket?
Mr.
Oh,
McLaren.
Yeah, so Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, yes, it has, right? So there has been transfers up to our holding company, down to Medica-affiliated services, to our insurance company, yes.
I think that's where the concern
gotcha.
Is.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a few amendments to this bill. Does anybody want to offer the A2 amendment? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, I like Representative Garofalo. I remember a conversation on the House floor relative to insurance, and this one had to do with limiting options in the state of Minnesota and something to do with SUPA, but I won't go there on that particular topic. But it does appear that House File 1378 and House File 1576 both move to limit options for insurance in the state of Minnesota when Minnesotans are really looking for options. I'm concerned that if this bill becomes law, that seniors may be hurt. And so the A2 amendment asks of the Department of Commerce, before this becomes law, to determine that there won't be a decrease in health and maintenance contracts in the state of Minnesota, a decrease in providers for seniors, and that premiums will not go up. And Madam Chair, I'm assuming that this will be a friendly amendment by the author.
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, I would accept the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Further discussion? Representative O'Driscoll moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Who would like to offer the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair, since I'm on a roll, I will.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Same idea, except this is for our small businesses and incubators to be their next Fortune 500 companies in the state of Minnesota. I want to make sure they don't get hurt as well. And I'm assuming this will also be a friendly amendment.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps I should have also brought this up in the last one, but is there a time frame for this? I mean, you know, one of the concerns that we have about the for-profits is that it looks great when they come in and grab the market share, and then it doesn't look so great. So I guess I would ask, you know, what time frame? There is no time frame on the amendment that I can tell. I mean, does this mean that it has to, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, the basic concept is fine, but, you know, maybe later on we should add something that says, but, you know, if there are decreases in the options, then we'll kick out the for-profits. But so I guess I would ask the author what his thinking is on the time frame.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling. My idea is that this will work in the normal course of business with Commerce as they do reviews on this. And, again, there are different regulators for with the Department of Health on some of these. So I suspect they'll be coordinating with them to make sure that Minnesota's options globally are not hurt as a result of this. So, again, I'm assuming this is a friendly amendment.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, and to the point that Representative Liebling made, I think that there are a couple of options that we can consider. It could be tied to rate setting that the Commerce Department approves or the Department of Health approves, because a lot of these plans are under the Department of Health. So I think that perhaps some further work could be done, because it sounds like you're pretty amenable to this idea and the impact it's going to have on consumers. Representative Liebling.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
So,
Representative O'Driscoll.
Chair, is that a friendly amendment, or that bill author is willing to take it, or?
Representative O'Driscoll, I would defer to the author.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would take that. I think, as I said, this is going to go through some more process. Certainly more work is going to be done, but I think the spirit of the amendment is a good one. So, you know, I assume that this is about, you know, meaningful options. Yes, I would accept the amendment.
And Madam Chair, if I might, because the other two amendments are very similar in nature, and perhaps we can just dispense with some of the finer details on this. I'm very concerned that if we swing the pendulum from nonprofits to allowing profits and swinging it back to nonprofits only, then we may end up injuring people along the way, unintended consequences. And so I'd like to have the regulators be required to take a look at this and keep it within focus so that we don't have less options for Minnesotans, that we have as many, if not more, options. So with that, Madam Chair.
So Representative O'Driscoll, do you want to clarify your motion? And are you withdrawing your amendment?
Oh, no, I would love to have it on. It sounds like the bill author is happy, and I would love to see all four of these go on, because it protects four different specific groups in the marketplace that are having difficulty getting coverage.
And Representative Liebling, is this an amendment you would like to accept, or would you like to work with the author on that? Okay. Then Representative O'Driscoll moves the A3 amendment.
No, Madam Chair, I'd like a roll call on it.
Representative O'Driscoll requests a roll call on the amendment. Sorry, members, it looks like we're not going to get there at 4, but we'll keep going.
It's all right.
The clerk will take the roll on the amendment.
This is for the House File 1378, Amendment A3, by Representative O'Driscoll. Halverson?
Aye.
Stevenson?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
Aye.
Carlson?
Yes.
Davids? Dean?
Aye.
Elkins?
Aye.
Garofalo? Haley? Howard?
Yes.
Katisa Watoon?
Aye.
Kreisha? Lesh? Lislegard?
Yes.
Mahoney? O'Neill?
Yes.
Richardson?
Yes.
Szczynski?
Yes.
Tapke?
Yes.
Tice?
Yes.
There being 15 ayes and 0 nays, the motion carries and the amendment is adopted. Would like to offer the A4 amendment.
Madam Chair, as I said, I have the A4 and the A5 amendment. The only difference between the A4 and the others that we have talked about is the group that needs to be looked after in this group, in this part of the insurance market. It's those who would be on medical assistance or enrollees in the Minnesota Care Program. I want to make sure that they are not negatively affected by this as well. Once again, assuming that this is a friendly amendment.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative O'Driscoll moves the A4 amendment. I would have a question to the author in terms of the jurisdiction. As the chair of the Health Finance Committee, is the jurisdiction the Department of Commerce or the Department of Health on this, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, thank you. It looks to me like this would be the jurisdiction of Department of Health and not Commerce.
Madam Chair, then I will.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Then if we can make an incorporation on line 1.17, the Commissioner of Health and Human Services making the determination and striking Commerce.
Representative O'Driscoll, I'm going to defer to nonpartisan staff because we want to be sure that we get the Commissioner Department correct. Ms. Pompeo.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, on line 1.7, it would change to the Commissioner of Health, as that's the agency that currently oversees review of HMO contracts.
Madam Chair,
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to nonpartisan staff, we would then strike the word Commissioner and insert the word Health in its place. Is that correct?
No, that would not be correct. It would strike the word Commerce and replace the word Health.
I'm sorry, yes. Commissioner of Health, strike Commerce.
Thank you for that clarification.
Madam Chair, can I just say that as an incorporation on the amendment?
Ms. Pompeo, can we incorporate that when we don't have to vote on it?
Madam Chair and members, this can be incorporated as an oral amendment to the A4.
Madam Chair, then I do so.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. It also appears that we have a similar reference on the line 1.1. Do you want to make that incorporation there as well?
Yes, Madam Chair, that would be appropriate to strike the word Commissioner in 1.11. Trying to get us moving along here. Commissioner of Commerce, strike the word Commerce, and in its place insert the word Health.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. And so we can incorporate that change as well with the author's go ahead. I want to be sure, Representative Liebling, that this reflects your understanding.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I had not seen any of these amendments before I walked in the room here. So I'm just realizing, too, that they all say Sections 1 to 7, which is basically an entire bill. So I wonder if it's the author's, Representative O'Driscoll's intent that the net earnings section that we had the conversation about should also not be effective until except in accordance with these amendments that he's offering. I don't know why it says Section 1 to 7 when that is essentially, that's the entire bill.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as Representative Liebling has pointed out, this bill does need some more work on other committee stops, but I think it's important that in the Commerce Committee, since this is the area that we have jurisdiction of looking out for people with insurance, that we get these on. I'm happy to continue to work with the author. She's willing to work with me in refining the language as we go on. But I think it's very important that we put a marker in place to take care of these folks in our Minnesota insurance market.
Representative Liebling?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess that, you know, I don't know why in the Department of Commerce Committee we would be doing things about what the Commissioner of Health responsibilities would be. You know, I think the underlying sentiment is right, but, you know, this goes into the issue about how we select plans for to serve people on public programs. And, you know, we don't just let, I think this takes a lot more consideration because it isn't just like anybody can walk in and offer a plan for public programs. There's a whole bidding process. This is, you know, a very controlled process. This has to do with how it impacts counties, you know, how many plans they have to deal with that are all serving the same pool of patients and so on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess I would ask the author, if you're serious about this, I certainly am willing to work with you, but I would ask you to withdraw this one because it really is, you know, I think there's a lot more here than meets the eye. And while the sentiment, as you see, I accepted your other ones, I don't think this one is really appropriate for right now.
And that's an interesting question, Representative Liebling, because I think that there might also be some interaction with the Department of Human Services as well. Now, are we referring this to Health and Human Services policy, and then I assume it's going to end up in the finance area?
That's
the path. And so the opportunity to get this in the committees with the proper jurisdiction over those parts of health care might be a good place for the two of you to continue to work on this. I have a couple member questions as well. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my understanding when we make oral amendments that although they should be short and to the point, they have to also be not too significant. And I think changing from one department to another department ends up being pretty significant change in the amendment. Now, that would be up to, you know, oh, we do this in Commerce?
We don't have rules.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I, once again, will refer to how I learned this lesson about germaneness in committees, and that was through the former chair of this committee, Representative.
It wasn't a question about germaneness. It was a question about the intention. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, Representative O'Driscoll, I kind of, maybe I'm taking this wrong, but she said time and time and time again that she's more than happy to work with her. But, of course, you apparently don't trust her, and you want to have it in the amendment as we have questions. So I'm not sure whether you're impugning the integrity of another member, but you're certainly giving that impression. So you might want to carefully choose your words better because, frankly, right now, at this point, this seems like a real political kind of mess rather than any concern you've ever shown, any concern that you're showing for people's financial issues or policy issues. That's just the way I'm reading it.
Representative O'Driscoll. Thank you. I'd also let Chair Mahoney know that some of the things he just made were impugning my motives. I won't take it that way, but one could be.
Representative Mahoney.
You know, someone impugned my motives about 8 or 9 years ago, and I've rarely talked to them since then. So I'll try to be kind here. But, yes, the way you said the phrase, that is quite concerning to me. And if you care to take it as impugning, that's your own business. But we do try once in a while around here to not step on people's integrity when they have said very clearly 3 times on the tape that they are happy to work with you, but there wasn't even a brush against the, well, I don't trust you, I need to have this amendment on. So take it as you wish.
Madam Chair,
Representative O'Driscoll.
since this is the committee that I'm in, I'm wanting to make sure that we take care of this group of people. I will see to it that this amendment gets reintroduced in the health policy and health and human and health finance committees. But again, this is important. I do not want to lose Minnesotans along the way on this. So, Madam Chair, I will withdraw the A4 at this time if you want to go to the A5.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, and just to confirm, it sounds like the author is willing to continue this work, and so
thank you.
Appreciate that. Who would like to move the A5 amendment?
And again, Madam Chair, as I said, I will offer this, and this is within the jurisdiction of Commerce because it does deal with the individual market, which is MNsure.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the A5 amendment. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And as I'm reading this, I have a concern about the fact that it's Section 107, which is the entire bill. And I don't think that these. Here's, Madam Chair. You know, I appreciate that members are really concerned. Representative O'Driscoll is really concerned about about the impact on what's available to consumers. I wish we had had as much concern when the for-profit provision was put into statute, because we did not. That is exactly the problem that we have. So, yeah, we should absolutely examine all of this. Now, when I look carefully at this amendment, it says under the sub one here, decreased health maintenance contract options for those purchasing individual health insurance. I'm not sure that we have that. So decreased, I guess we couldn't have less than none. So maybe that's not a problem. I don't have any, again, I don't have any real underlying concern about, you know, we all share, as I said, the concern about making sure that consumers have good options for getting health care at a reasonable price, et cetera. I think we can fix all of this later on. It seems these are not well thought out, and I do wish that we had thought more carefully about, as I said, about the having for-profits in the first place, but we certainly ought to examine the whole topic in with more care. And so I would accept the amendment. We can fix the goofiness in it later.
Well, thank you, Representative. Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Liebling. I sincerely do appreciate your willingness to take this, because this is not a Democrat issue or a Republican issue. This is a Minnesota issue, and I have a number of constituents, as does everyone around this table, who have concerns every time the legislature and Congress and others start looking at insurance, meaning what am I going to have, what am I not going to have available. And I just want to make sure that we take the right and appropriate steps to help people be pointed in the right direction and in an affordable direction for coverage, and that they maintain their options. So, Representative Liebling, I do appreciate that, and I do not need a roll call on this if it's a friendly amendment, and I do sincerely want to continue to work with you, Representative Liebling. I've got a number of years in the industry in different parts of this and do want to continue to work with you. Thank you, Representative Liebling and Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, and thank you, Representative Liebling, for the spirit of cooperation and both of your willingness to work together on this. Representative O'Driscoll moves the A5 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Liebling, those are all the amendments in front of us. Did you have any additional?
Well, thank you, members, for the spirited discussion. I think it is really important that we discuss these issues, and I hope that we will take more time to discuss whether bringing for-profits into our insurance landscape for health insurance was a good thing, is a good thing, and how we can put the proper guardrails around it if we're going to keep it. And with the amendments, I guess that my section that's is kind of really important to me about the net earnings might not be effective, but we do have another bill on that topic. This issue is not going to go away. I strongly feel that we need to put that section back into statute. If we do nothing else, apparently we really need that. So thank you, members, for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Just once more, we had taken up some amendments before we finished making sure that everybody from the public has been heard on this bill. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none.
Madam Chair, I'd like a roll call, please.
Representative Sorry, O'Driscoll requests a roll call on the bill. I will renew my motion that House File 1378, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy. The clerk will take the roll on the bill.
This is a roll call for House File 1378. Halverson?
Aye.
Stevenson?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Carlson?
Yes.
Davids? Dean?
Yes.
Elkins?
Yes.
Garofalo? Haley? Howard?
Yes.
Katisa Watoon?
Yes.
Kreisha? Lesh? Lislegard?
Yes.
Mahoney?
Yep.
O'Neill? Richardson?
Yes.
Swazinski?
No.
Tabke?
Yes.
Tice?
No.
There being 11 ayes and 3 nays, the motion carries, and your bill is on the way to Health and Human Services. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Cantrell. Because of the length of time, and again, this being a holiday, we are going to move House File 572 to Friday's committee hearing. With that, we are adjourned.